Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
In recession, there is opportunity for those with the intestinal fortitude to step up. A multi-billion dollar bet on the shaky shopping habits of the American consumer would seem to fit that requirement. There is big news today in shopping malls, believe it or not. Also letters and Mardi Gras, family style. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. And by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today the 16th of February, and it is good to have you here. American consumers, as we all know, aren't really doing much buying these days. That has been the retail through line the past couple of years. But somehow there is shopping going on in the shopping mall business. Today, the country's largest mall operator, that's a company named Simon Property, announced a $10 billion offer for its biggest rival, General Growth. General has been operating under the kind of protection of a bankruptcy court since this past spring, which tells you something about the overall business environment in retail real estate. But if the deal does go through, Simon would control a third of all the shopping malls in this country. From Washington, Brett Neely has more.
Simon and General Growth are like the Coke and Pepsi of the mall business. They own lots of high-end malls that skew towards Nordstrom rather than Sears. That's why Simon has wanted to buy General Growth since it declared bankruptcy last spring, says Ivan Friedman, who runs RCS Real Estate Advisors.
What this means is Simon is eliminating its largest competitor.
Sam Chandon of Real Capital Analytics says both companies ran their malls well, but the financial crisis affected them differently. Simon Property played it safe. General Growth was caught overextended when the credit markets dried up.
This really is about how it is that they made choices around taking on new debt.
Now Simon has the upper hand, not just with its rival. Analyst Ivan Friedman says most big national retail chains have about half their stores in malls run by Simon and General Growth. If a merger goes through, those retailers could get squeezed when negotiating leases.
Now I'm going to have one landlord for 50% of the stores. It's going to be tougher to negotiate with Simon.
Scott Krugman at the National Retail Federation says retailers should be worried.
When you see a merger like this, and you see one group with such dominant market share, it could stifle competition, and that could have a direct impact on retailers that are trying to expand.
Analysts told me shoppers probably won't notice a thing. They said the economy means most stores won't be able to pass rent increases on to their customers. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
High-speed connections are where it's at in the Internet. Google, as we mentioned to you a couple of days ago, is working on a big broadband project. The Obama administration is spending billions of dollars to bring high-speed access to virtually every corner of the country. Today, though, the Commerce Department reported that even in places where broadband is available, not everybody wants it. Seems for all the fuss, a lot of people just aren't interested. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Lots of us couldn't imagine life without high-speed internet, and Congress has been spending billions so that everyone has access to it, if they want it. But the Commerce Department did a survey last fall and found that 38% of the households surveyed who don't have broadband just don't want it. Who are they?
It will be older Americans. It will be less educated Americans. It will be poorer populations.
Larry Strickling heads the branch of the Commerce Department that released the data. Strickling says the government is not just focused on expanding broadband access, it's also funding programs that teach computer and internet skills. Strickling says today, broadband in the home is essential.
If you want to apply for a job, you need to be on the internet. If children want to do their homework, they need to have broadband access. So it's very hard to be successful in today's society without this access.
Joseph Turo is a professor of communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He says seniors might be more interested in broadband if they knew that hospitals are starting to use it to monitor patients in their homes.
Even having a physician in a hospital watch a nurse or an aide do a certain kind of procedure to make sure it's being done correctly.
The Commerce Department also found that people don't have broadband because it's too expensive. Jeff Chester heads the Center for Digital Democracy. He says the government should force the big companies to rent space on their high-speed networks to smaller competitors.
You don't want to have a choice between, you know, A or B, cable or phone. You want to have, you know, dozens of providers with different kinds of plans.
Chester says that would force prices down. He thinks if the price is right, interest in broadband will suddenly pick up. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
There's magic happening in Las Vegas today, not just the kind where guys in sequined suits make ladies disappear either. Magic is the name of a big conference of fashion buyers and sellers that's happening this week. That may help explain why someone chose right now to leak a rumor that Madonna may be releasing her own clothing line. That and a little thing called Fashion Week that's happening in New York City right now. But no matter the reason, Marketplace's Rico Galliano reports that if the rumor is true, it would be one of the biggest, but certainly not the only, examples of superstars hitting the runway this year.
Women's Wear Daily broke the news. They quote anonymous sources that say Madonna will license her name to a fashion line to be sold solely at Macy's department store. Neither Macy's nor, big surprise, Madonna returned calls today asking to confirm. But if it's true, the line would be a big deal, especially for Macy's. Marshall Cohen is a retail analyst with the NPD Group.
One of the big issues that retailers have been wrestling with is how do they separate themselves from one another? And by getting in partnership with a celebrity or a designer and having exclusive product, it's one of the best ways to differentiate yourself.
Still, both celebrity and retailer have to be careful not to tarnish a star's brand. Cohen says for every celebrity fashion line that succeeds, two fail.
In some cases, like Sarah Jessica Parker and the Venus Williams lines, these were products that were in partnership with a retailer who was trying to sell them at really low prices and making the product at very low quality. In some cases, they had fit issues, quality issues, and even style issues.
Which explains why some stars do more than just let someone stitch their names into a T-shirt. Last summer, the Olsen twins were actually inducted into the Council of Fashion Designers for their work on their clothing line, The Row. And Jessica Simpson is reportedly hands-on with the line that bears her name. Leah Waba is a VP at the Camuto Group, which owns the Simpson license.
She will be wearing a coat, and she'll say, you know what, I would like to see the pocket slant sideways as opposed to be vertical, because women want flatter and cut, and they need to be on the side.
Then again, maybe you don't always want a hands-on approach. Jenny Farley, also known as J-Wow on the trashy reality show Jersey Shore, she's got a fashion line this year, too. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
You remember the Greek debt problem? Yeah, what Greek debt problem? The euro rose today, the dollar fell, oil was up, equities too on Wall Street. It is amazing how fast things turn around, isn't it? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Stimulus is the economic word of the week around the White House. Vice President Biden and various cabinet members have been dispatched to celebrate the first anniversary of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. President Obama signed the stimulus package into law a year ago tomorrow. So, 1 year and hundreds of billions of dollars later, did it work? Well, as with many things economic, it kind of depends on who you ask. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has been asking around to get some answers. Bob?
Hey, Kai, this could all boil down to who do you trust? To hear President Obama tell it during his State of the Union address last month, leading economists and business leaders have pronounced the stimulus a big success.
But you don't have to take their word for it. Talk to the small business in Phoenix that will triple its workforce because of the Recovery Act. Talk to the window manufacturer in Philadelphia who said he used to be skeptical about the Recovery Act until he had to add two more work shifts just because of the business it created.
And the president has some numbers he can point to, right, Bob? I mean, the gross domestic product is up, the
true.
Biggest measure of the economy, and the number of jobs we're losing is down.
True, but don't look now. The all-important American consumer still isn't spending all that much.
Mm-hmm.
The unemployment rate is still hovering close to 10%. And there's a new wave of foreclosures right around the corner, they tell us. And some Republican critics say that shows it's been a waste of money, or at least not worth all that we've been spending. But the New York Times did run a story at the end of last year citing what it called a new consensus of more dispassionate analysts who've been insisting, hey, we could have done even worse without the stimulus.
Could have, as in we don't know yet?
Mm-hmm. Let me set the mood for you here.
All right. Catchy tune, yeah.
Can you name that tune?
No.
It's an old standard, how little we know. And I'm dropping that in here because that's how one economist I spoke to actually headlined one of his recent commentaries.
Wait, how little we know, as in he doesn't know, as in he's guessing?
We don't know. Nobody can really know for sure, and that's what this all comes down to.
We spent $787 billion on guesses.
Well, when the Obama administration was selling this plan, mm-hmm. they pointed to their own economists who use formulas to say, this is where we think the economy is headed.
Right.
Now they're using those same formulas to say, this is where the economy would have been, and this is where we are now. And then along comes a respected Stanford University economist, Professor John Taylor, to complain that that's like trying to prove a negative.
You can always say things would be worse in a given situation. You get a new set of golf clubs and they don't improve your game, and you say, well, my game would have been worse without those golf clubs. But sometimes it's just not plausible.
In fact, Taylor says he actually saw signs of a nascent recovery even before any of the stimulus spending started. And he's in the camp of free market economists who worry that all the borrowing the government's had to do might be crowding out business investment.
Crowding out as in what? Help me out here.
Well, remember how much investors from China to mom and pop folks have been buying treasuries as a safe place to put their money? Well, that could actually be pulling investment away from the private sector companies who we keep hearing still find it hard to get financing for what they might otherwise be doing.
So that is to say the stimulus package is actually preventing others from investing in this economy.
Well, that's what these critics suggest.
You and I could have another conversation along these lines, and instead of John Taylor, we could throw Paul Krugman's name in there.
Uh-huh,
he's on the more left side of the economic mm-hmm. spectrum, and he would say, by God, you had to have that stimulus package because it's all about consumer confidence, as you mentioned, and how the people had to know the government was coming to the rescue.
You know what this brings to mind, Kai? That old joke that if you laid all the economists in the world end to end, they'd never reach a conclusion.
So we don't know what we don't know, right? Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Guy.
Today is Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras, if you're in New Orleans. The parts of that city that bothered to open up after the Saints won the Super Bowl a couple of weeks ago have probably shut back down because hundreds of thousands of people take to the streets to celebrate Mardi Gras every year. Among all the flying beads and frozen daiquiris, though, at least one person is going to be working. And at this very moment, he is trying to change the way you and I think about Mardi Gras. From New Orleans, David Weinberg has more.
Can one man armed only with an iPhone and a Twitter account change brand perception? New Orleans marketing consultant Tom Martin is on a mission to find out.
I made up the entire experiment while eating a Whopper in the parking lot of a Burger King, and I was looking at they were putting up all the Mardi Gras stuff.
Martin wanted to see if he could change common perceptions of Mardi Gras as a raucous celebration of public drunkenness and indecent exposure. Before last year's festivities, Martin sent out a survey to get a sense of how 180 of his Twitter followers viewed the holiday. Most associated Mardi Gras with words like crazy and flashing, words that didn't reflect how Martin and his family observe Mardi Gras.
People here have always wanted to change the impression of Mardi Gras, but they've just never been able to.
Over the next 5 days, Martin sent hundreds of tweets with posts and photographs depicting the family-friendly side of Mardi Gras. The images showed parents and their kids watching parades, hanging out at tailgate parties, and playing in local parks. At the end, Martin sent a follow-up survey. He found more respondents associated Mardi Gras with words like family, tailgating, and food.
I call it a breadcrumb theory of marketing, and that is if I drop the breadcrumbs the right way, a reasonably logical individual is going to get to the end point that I want them to get to.
Martin is repeating the effort again this year, but this time he's contracted with about a dozen bloggers from around the country to come to New Orleans and tweet about their perceptions of Mardi Gras. Among them is Taylor Davidson. Last Friday, he turned out for a parade in the residential uptown neighborhood. Despite the chilly weather, thousands of people lined up along Napoleon Avenue to see floats, marching bands, and the always popular Flying Elvi.
Like, how cool is it to be a part of, like, a group of 100 guys dressed in full Elvis regalia on scooters?
Lifelong resident Sims Favreau was also in attendance with his wife and daughter.
Throw me something, mister!
I know we're talking on radio, but if you look around, it's families, it's kids. It is a family event, first and foremost. And secondarily, there's some decadence. It's like saying Christmas is nothing but drunken office parties.
And some local businesses are looking to piggyback on Tom Martin's wholesome images of Mardi Gras. The downtown Sheraton Hotel offered to put the bloggers up for free in exchange for a promotional tie-in. and the McElhenney Company, which makes Tabasco sauce, provided funding for this year's efforts. Jan Carroll is a spokeswoman for McElhenney.
For us, we're interested in changing perceptions about this city that we really do consider our home.
But first impressions die hard. Even after last year's onslaught of family-friendly tweets, nearly 60% of Tom Martin's survey respondents still associated Mardi Gras with the word crazy. In New Orleans, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
If you, like I, wonder what a family-friendly Mardi Gras might look like, go no further than our website. We've got pictures and some of those blog posts, marketplace.org. Coming up, sending money abroad while scrimping at home.
Haiti was always dependent on money from the diaspora, and now even more so. And, you know, we barely may have enough to make it here.
But first, let's do the numbers. The number we start off with today is 3, as in stocks advanced by their best daily percentage in 3 months. The Dow Industrials climbed 169 points today, 1 2/3%. Closed at 10,268. The NASDAQ bounced 30 points, 1.4%, ended at 22.14. The S&P 500 added 19 points, 1.8%, wrapped up trading at 1,094. Some encouraging profit reports helped pump things up a bit. Some of the market's strongest medicine came from Merck. The stock rose an even 2% after the drug maker reported strong quarterly earnings. That news helped boost Bristol-Myers Squibb and GlaxoSmithKline by better than 1% apiece, but it was no pick-me-up for shares of rival Pfizer, which lost nearly a half of 1%. Bank of America was the leading Dow component. The stock surged nearly 5% today after the financial giant reported, quote, significant gains in its handling of modified mortgages. Bond prices lost ground, pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 3.66%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals at Vanguard.com. And by Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at Microsoft.com/cloud services. Let us give you the business 24 hours a day. Just tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest financial news and reports from around the globe on how the economy is affecting our lives. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up tomorrow. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of January. The Federal Reserve releases industrial production figures for January. And Christians around the world observe Ash Wednesday, the beginning of Lent. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
We start our letters segment today with unemployment, not people who are actually jobless, but with a group that until not too long ago was left out of the conversation about the labor market, the underemployed, people who've been laid off and can now only find part-time jobs or fewer hours for less money. Pam Gilchrist from Cincinnati, Ohio, knows that topic all too well.
My husband was laid off last spring, and it took him, you know, 6 or 8 months to find a new position, and the new position that he found pays about 50% less than it did previously. So he's regressed back to a salary that he made 10 years ago.
Robert Reich brought a personal angle to his commentary last week on health insurance. He was talking about Anthem's proposed 39% rate increase for individual policyholders. Bob is an Anthem customer, and he pointed out that Anthem said it has no choice but to raise prices because so many people have dropped their coverage because they can't afford it. That's the part that made Joey Iverson from St. Paul, Minnesota say,
Anthem claims they're raising costs in part because nobody can afford their insurance anymore. Think on that.
Rico Galliano did some thinking last week on airlines and how they're charging for every little thing nowadays, including, most recently, American Airlines wanting $8 for a pillow and blanket.
In a few minutes, we'll be cutting off the supply of oxygen in the economy cabin. Additional oxygen can be purchased for a nickel per minute. Just slip your coins into the slot in the armrest.
Tom Suggs from Lexington, Kentucky, says there is one more thing that they could charge for.
About the only thing Mr. Galliano left off was the takeoff fee. Just because the airlines can't leave people on the tarmac for more than a few hours doesn't mean that they can't charge for a timely departure.
Believe me when I tell you that that's get really struck a chord, easily the most commented upon thing we've done the past couple of weeks. Finally, an object lesson in the perils of covering the American economy. A couple of Fridays ago, Felix Salmon, one of the regulars in our weekly wrap, said this as a part of a conversation about how the president can create new jobs.
Of course, infrastructure investment is an extremely expensive way of creating jobs. It costs a good $200,000 per job.
A couple of days later, we got a letter from a listener, somebody who's been on the show a couple of times, actually, Representative Peter DeFazio, Democrat of Oregon. The congressman took issue with Felix's $200,000 a job figure. He says the number's really closer to $92,000 a job. That's according to the president's Council of Economic Advisors, Mr. DeFazio told us. Felix got his estimate from a private consulting firm called Economic Modeling Specialists Incorporated. So what is the object lesson here? That what you believe about business and the economy depends in very great measure on who you talk to and what economists you read. That is why we put links to the studies and economic models both Felix and Congressman DeFazio quoted on our website, so you can have a look and maybe decide for yourselves. It's marketplace.org. That's our website. And while you're there, even if you're not a congressman, drop us a line. The link you need is in the top right corner. It's the one that says contact. The most recent estimate for the cost of rebuilding Haiti is coming in at the high end of earlier guesses. The Inter-American Development Bank said today that it could be as much as $14 billion. You consider the state of the Haitian economy pre-quake, and obviously most of that money is coming from overseas, from foreign countries, from corporations, and from individual contributions. A lot of Haitian expatriates here in the United States are giving all they can, and then some, as Sally Herships reports.
Michelle Guerrier lives with her husband, son, and her mother in Brooklyn. They have a three-story white house and a white cat named Mimi. Guerrier had been setting aside a little money from each paycheck.
It was supposed to be a little extra savings, but, you know, it's not going to be that.
Guerrier is Haitian-American, and like many from her Brooklyn community, she's sending money back to Haiti and feeling a pinch.
Haiti was always dependent on money from the diaspora. And now, even more so. And, you know, we barely may have enough to make it here.
This could not have happened at a worse time for Haitians.
That's Rico Dupree. He's director of Radio Soleil, which broadcasts from Brooklyn. Dupree says while unemployment in the U.S. is high, it's even higher in the Black community, almost 16%. And he says for Haitian Americans, it's higher still.
It is a struggle because of the predicament they find themselves in. And a huge number of them have lost their jobs. Those that have jobs, their jobs have become more and more precarious.
Even so, Dupree says Haitians in the States are doubling, tripling, even quadrupling the amounts they send home.
Normally you send money to loved ones, to immediate family. But now they find themselves being solicited by people they're not related to, but they desperate anybody they know. They contact the person and hoping that they will do something.
For Haitians living in the U.S. who have a lot of connections back home, that can mean big financial pressure.
Let me call you back. Let me call you back, please. I'll call you back. I'm on the mic.
A few blocks away, I stop by Radio Panu, a Haitian pirate radio station. One of the hosts, Gaspar Lynch, has just come off the air. His cell phone is ringing off the hook with calls from around the U.S. and Haiti. Six of his family members died in the quake, but others, like his son, made it through. Now his remaining family is sleeping on a soccer field Lynch owns, and Lynch has a pocket full of receipts for money transfers to them.
You see, this is from MoneyGram. This is from Western Union, you see?
Lynch started sending money back to Haiti when he first came to the States in 1979. He built houses for him and his family. He also built a restaurant and even a home for street kids. Up until last month, he says it housed 1,300 children, but everything was leveled by the earthquake. Lynch pulls a stack of photos out of his briefcase.
This is my house in Haiti. You know how I built this?
Lynch says when he started building, he was a truck driver. He didn't have enough cash to pay for a whole house, so it took him years, buying $100 worth of sand and cement at a time and setting them aside till he was ready.
So how much money is it going to cost to rebuild all your houses?
For now, almost $1.5 million.
American dollars.
American dollars. Yeah. I don't know how I'm going to rebuild.
But even though he has to start from scratch, Lynch says he's hopeful. All the money it took to build his life in Haiti, he earned here, in this country. And he says he knows other Haitian Americans will join him in starting to build again. Back at Radio Soleil, a new song comes on the air. It's in Creole. So I ask station director Rico Dupree what the lyrics say.
It's a song that tried to describe the predicament we find ourselves as a country, as a people. He's saying that don't despair. We'll survive this. We have to.
In Brooklyn, New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
If you're still looking for ways to give to help earthquake victims in Haiti, there are some links on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by the New Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
A final note on the way out today, which can variously be interpreted as this week's sign, the apocalypse is upon us, or the blessed last gasp of Twitter. I don't know if you saw this, but the American International Toy Fair started Sunday in New York. Believe it or not, people are already talking about what's going to be on store shelves come Christmas time. But that's not what I wanted to mention. This is Mattel is offering, and I kid you not, a dog collar that tweets. Depending on what a Fido does, the thing automatically generates one of 500 random tweets to the dog's account. Why? Well, we can't help you there, but I can tell you that you can buy one for $29.95, believe it or not. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 169 points, 1 2/3%. Don't know what Mattel's share price was at today. The NASDAQ added 30 points, 1.4%. The S&P 500 gained 19 points, 1.8%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Doug Krisner on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time on this broadcast, Rebuilding Haiti with Haitians.
There are meaningful long-term jobs in the construction sector. That have very few qualified people to fill. And so we've got to address that.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.